This is Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. On this edition, a conversation with Ron Paul about the billions of taxpayer dollars spent meddling in the political affairs of foreign nations like Ukraine, plus sanctions and their long track record of failure in international relations. We'll also hear from a man who apologized to America for his role in running the quantitative easing money printing spree at the Federal Reserve. A special conversation with Andrew Huszar, who says the Fed has created the prospect for out-of-control economic conditions in America. Now, here are Ron Paul and Charles Goyette.
And thank you for joining us on the new expanded weekly podcast, and especially for sharing it with your friends and family. And with that said, let's speak with Ron Paul about the billions of taxpayer dollars spent meddling in the political affairs of foreign nations under cover of the benevolent-sounding National Endowment for Democracy. And with the U.S. busy prevailing on the G7 nations to tighten the sanctions screws on Russia, it would also be a good time to talk with him about the long track record that these sanctions have, a record of failure, that is. So, Dr. Paul, although the National Endowment for Democracy has been around for more than 30 years, it's a pretty good bet that most Americans have no idea what's being done in their name around the world.
There's no doubt about it. It's a pretend private organization, but it is just government with a different name because some of them get a lot of money from the taxpayer. There are some non-governmental organizations that are private, but they're not as important as the big ones for the National Endowment for Democracy, where they get a lot of taxpayers' dollars. You know, and just this recent history is significant because of their involvement in Ukraine. We know that just recently it was revealed by Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, that they've been involved, and she bragged about how the National Endowment for Democracy has been involved over there for years and promoting democracy in that country. But it turns out that they've been around for a long time. Matter of fact, I went back and looked at one of my little statements in the the Foreign Affairs Committee back 10 years ago when the Orange Revolution was coming up, where we were very much involved and our National Endowment for Democracy was involved, and I was expressing a great deal of concern. What are we doing here? Why are we spending this money? It could lead to a lot of problems. And yet, here they've had the 10 years to promote democracy, and now there's crisis in the very area where they've been working, and lo and behold, guess what? It's all Russia's fault. Now, that'd be great, and it sounds like you have to be a great patriot to blame somebody else. But if our policies are leading to the trouble, to deny it is very, very dangerous. So this is what we're doing. We're denying that we haven't been involved for 10 years. And even this recent takeover, they say, well, it's Russia's aggression and invasion, which is not true. There was a takeover of an elected government in Ukraine. And so it represented the failure of our policy. So Yanukovych was an elected leader. He was run out of town. It was a combination of what United States authorities were doing along with European authorities. And matter of fact, we have the evidence about it. You know, not only does Nuland admit the money's been spent to be involved, but also she was caught on a telephone plotting with the ambassador, Pyatt. And they were planning, who should we put in place? Who we should take over? And the person they named ended up in charge. So, yes, we've been very much involved. And matter of fact, you might even make the case that if we had not been involved in being aggressive under NATO and just going up to the very doorstep of Russia, like we have in Georgia, actually NATO has a presence in Georgia. And now there's this squabble going on in Crimea. So, yes, the NGOs are very, very important. And then when they get into trouble, the same people who caused the trouble say, well, it's all their fault. We're going to punish them. Well, we're not ready to invade and take them on militarily, but we're going to put on sanctions. We're going to steal their money, the money that they have in Western banks. We're going to just take it from them and punish certain individuals. Generally speaking, though, sanctions are directed toward a country to get people to be punished so that the leadership will come around and do our bidding. It essentially never works that way. It usually punishes the people. If you look at the sanctions in Iraq, hundreds of thousands of children died because they were denied medical care and food and just life-sustaining efforts. And yet the leaders never suffered until, of course, the very end. But generally speaking, it makes the people suffer, but also the people who had to pay, and that's our people. And it's not the rich people in this country. You think the bankers are going to suffer? No, they're going to get a bailout if they get into trouble. So the poor people in this country, get the benefit. So the sanctions lead to more sanctions and more trouble. Our behind the scenes manipulation of elections lead to more trouble. And I just do not believe there's any benefit. Of course, right now they're trying to claim, well, oh, they've worked in Iran. Iran's now talking to us and we've been willing to. Well, if a person looks carefully at that history, they will find out that more than 200 years now, the Iranians have never invaded anybody. And we orchestrated an invasion of Iran, with Iraq early on. And now they are talking, and yet they've offered to talk numerous times. They were offering help after 9/11. So there's a lot of subterfuge on this, a lot of debate in public. But the truth is, our behind-the-scenes manipulation of elections and picking and choosing dictators is very, very dangerous to our national security. It's dangerous to our economic stability. And the ultimate evil from all this, it generally leads to military conflict. It certainly did, in Iraq, in many, many other places. Of course, we were involved in places like Vietnam for years and years, as trying to influence what was going on there. And look at the fight we got in Vietnam, which we lost and suffered from. And now the same thing, there's some who are pushing this now, in Crimea. They think we should not only put on sanctions, but there are some that are very dedicated to the use of force. And the accusation is, if I or others that agree with me aren't that gung-ho about sanctions, manipulating elections, and sending over troops, but somehow or another we're unpatriotic. But I would argue the case that maybe patriotism is defending this country and this country's freedom, and sure our freedoms are not undermined here at home, and staying out of trouble overseas, stay out of these internal squabbles, internal affairs of other nations, and really avoiding these international conflict and these international agreements. We need a lot more of that policy than the kind of policies we've been following and the trouble that we've been getting into. And right now, you know what? It looks like the American people are coming with us. Statistics are showing the pressure was put on Obama not to bomb Syria, to talk to the Iranians, and the American people don't want us to send troops into Ukraine. Unfortunately, the Congress is not listening, and they're taking more money from the American people and sending it over to Ukraine right now. And who knows where that money is going, but believe me, it will not help the Ukrainian people. It will be used paying up some debts to some bank someplace. And just because we're offering $1 billion now means only that that's opening up the door, because it will be tens of billions of dollars before it's all over. Unless the world wakes up and finds out that this dollar reserve standard is not worth supporting.
Well, you mentioned the war hawks that want to send arms to Ukraine and actually send soldiers over there. One of them is Thomas Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute. By the way, he was an executive officer of the disreputable Project for the New American Century that said America needed a new Pearl Harbor-style event before 9/11, something that would galvanize us to want to become a global military empire and so on. But in any event, he says now preserving the peace on the Eurasian landmass, the whole Eurasian landmass, demands land forces. And he's talking specifically about American troops to begin with in Ukraine. But Dr. Paul, they have really let a genie out of the bottle with this thing, the Victoria Nuland types in the State Department. Now I understand that Poland, on Ukraine's western border, has called Army reservists up to duty. And the former Prime Minister of Ukraine, Yulia Tymoshenko, has apparently been caught on tape, just as Victoria Nuland was caught on tape, And she's urging effectively the slaughter of millions of Russians that live in Ukraine.
You know, this is all true. I believe what you have just said. And you would think that maybe it would make the news. But it bothers me more than ever how uniformly biased the news is today. Because the news has always been bad. We've complained about it. But in this episode is absolutely solidified, you know, on one side, so they don't present this news. The American people would respond differently. The only hope we have now is that we get this information out through things like podcasts and through the internet and different vehicles, because it looks like we'll no more see the change in the format of all the news outlets on national television, then we'll see all of a sudden tomorrow morning, there's not a neocon influence on Congress. You know, that's not going to happen. But some people will say, well, why don't you just give it up if the odds are so badly stacked against you, if you have the government and the media totally biased? Because we live in a different age now, and this different age has already had an influence. And when they do the polling, the American people are waking up. So this message is getting out. So this is one reason why I hope things like our podcasts and other things we do on the internet will be successful.
And I want to loop back to sanctions for just a moment. I was counting the other day the American presidents that the Castro brothers in Cuba have outlasted. And by my count, they have been there outlasting 10 American presidents. They're still there after sanctions that were imposed more than 50 years ago, back in 1960, actually, and they have had nothing of an impact other than hunkering the people down and digging in their heels rather than capitulation.
It is sad because if we would have responded to the crack in the door with Cuba, which has been around for a long time, and other nations have snuck through that crack, I think that would have undermined the system. And so the sanctions actually did exactly the opposite. And right now, there's every reason in the world for us to be starting to talk to the Cubans. But in some ways, it's been slow in coming. It's so tedious. But there is a influence now. There's a much greater support for this now, even with some of the Cuban Americans. You know, one thing I found out during the campaign, Cuban Americans, if they were from a certain generation, an older generation, no, they weren't able to see any reason conceivable to, open up a door and at least talk to somebody in Cuba, thinking that maybe times would change. The younger generation was much more open to us. They'd like to travel to Cuba and visit with their grandparents and that sort of thing. But right now, I think that whole thing is shifting. Congress is the last group to figure it out, just as they are so often, you know, whether it's military intervention or sanctions against Cuba or the drug war here at home. It's that's, to me, the frustrating thing. I'm not frustrated with impossibility of changing people's minds, but it is a little frustrating. We'd like to be able to wave a wand and change people's attitude and say, hey, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Instead of pursuing this course of total bankruptcy, which we're on, which won't be pretty. But even then, even if we do accept the fact that we may have to face the consequence of total bankruptcy, at least we want in place a group of people who have a better set of positions and answers about markets and freedom and different things, because there will be a vacuum there and it has to be replaced. And that's why I remain very eager and determined, especially since we're getting a response from a younger generation, and that's pretty important.
Well, you've certainly had an outsized impact on changing people's attitudes about interventionism, both interference in the economy and interventionism overseas and the consequences that we get. Thank you, Dr. Paul, for your insights and for another great conversation.
The Federal Reserve has printed more than $4 trillion, a quarter of the U.S. GDP. Coming up next, the Fed official who said, "I'm sorry, America," right after this on Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast.
Having been through the car buying experience yourself, you'll be so glad to know about a new way to buy a car. TrueCar.com is changing everything. TrueCar.com is the simple, fair and fun way to buy a car. At TrueCar.com, you know when you'll get a fair price because they show you what others paid for the car you're looking for. And TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. The TrueCar process, three simple steps to guaranteed savings. First, you go to TrueCar.com and find out what others paid for the same vehicle in your market and around the country. Second, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings certificate. And then the third step is so simple. Just print out your certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. TrueCar.com has the most comprehensive new car pricing information available and a certified network of dealers that offer a hassle-free car buying experience and negotiation-free guaranteed savings. It's so simple, it's really hassle-free. Just go to TrueCar.com. TrueCar. TrueCar.com.
Now, Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast, continues. Here's Charles with today's special guest.
It's a surprise, but it's good to hear someone inside the Federal Reserve admit what we've been saying all along. Richard Fisher, president of the Dallas Fed, has confessed, at least briefly, that the Fed's quantitative easing, money printing, has been a massive gift to the very wealthy. The Fed's money printing has made the rich richer. But I think that Richard Fisher may be a little late to the party, and I'd like you to meet Andrew Huszar, who was called back to the Fed in 2009 to run quantitative easing, QE1, in which the Fed set out to purchase $1.25 trillion of bonds. That's quite a spree. But last fall, our guest wrote a confession in the Wall Street Journal that really rocked the world, in my view, about his role in the Wall Street feeding frenzy, and it was called Confessions of a Quantitative Easer. Andrew Huszar is a senior fellow at Rutgers Business School, and you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Huszar. That's Andrew Huszar, H-U-S-Z-A-R. And with that, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Is Richard Fisher late to the party? You were the first guy out of the blocks to really, at least from inside the Fed, to say what, in your view, had actually transpired in this process.
Well, certainly. I mean, I to be fair, I believe a lot of people outside the Fed have been explaining, or at least pointing out some of the issues for several years. But I got to a point, in my own career, in my own life, where I felt compelled to speak up and hopefully to try to influence the Fed to pull back from its stimulus and hopefully get back to normal.
Well, I'd like to loop back around and have you tell us a little bit of the backstory and what you were actually responsible for doing. But let me just move ahead of ourselves a little bit here and ask you, have you suffered any blowback or repercussions from having come out in this manner?
I must say we live in a wonderful country where we do have free speech and subsequent to my putting out the op-ed, I did get a lot of attention. I gave a lot of interviews, but for the large part, it's been relatively straightforward in terms of my life, which is, you know, again, we have to celebrate. We do live in America where you can speak up, and that's been very, very refreshing, and I'm grateful for that.
That's good to hear. And so you were in the private sector, having worked at the Fed before, when you got a call or an invitation to run quantitative easing one. Can you tell us the backstory a little bit?
Sure. So I had actually worked at the Fed for about 8 years. I'd finished graduate school at Columbia University. I did a JD MBA there and graduated in 2001, and had worked originally as an attorney and then as a regulator at the Fed for a number of years before leaving out of some frustration right before the financial crisis really escalated. And I had taken a job on Wall Street for a little more than a year. When I did get this call in the spring of 2009, asking me, if you can believe it, to run what is essentially the largest stimulus program in world history, which was this $1.25 trillion program to buy mortgage bonds from the private sector. Basically, our job, the team that I was managing, our job was basically to buy one-tenth of the U.S. housing market equivalent within about 15 months. And so the Fed had really never bought a mortgage bond before the financial crisis, and suddenly it was our job to figure out how to do it and actually to execute that program.
And you left after QE1 and weren't there for the rest of the ride then?
I did. I left because out of a bit of disillusionment. I had returned thinking that I was helping to do something whereby the Fed was going to help a larger process in the U.S. of really taking stock of what had happened after the financial crisis and hopefully helping to facilitate a process where we could hopefully right-size the banking sector and put in place some meaningful structural reforms to ensure that something like this wouldn't happen again. And really, after QE1, when the program really didn't work in the way that it had been advertised, and where I was seeing in the larger context that we were really just putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak, I got to a point where I did get frustrated, and when QE2 was announced, that for me was the moment when I realized that the stimulus was going to continue, and that really I really wasn't the right person to continue to work on the program.
Well, you described in your Wall Street Journal piece in November, you described the process as billions of dollars of opaque Fed subsidies for Wall Street, and that the Fed had lost any ability to think independently from Wall Street. What about the working people? If that was the policy decision, what about the working people, your colleagues, the economists, the staff of the Fed? How widespread were your qualms or your questions?
Well, I should say, to be fair, that I do believe in the Fed, and I do believe that the people inside the Fed are generally very smart and well-intentioned people. I think what has happened is really, and this is a longer-term process that it actually took decades, but I believe that the institution on some level has lost perspective, and that really the financial crisis was the moment where it jumped the shark, if you want to say, if you want to put it that way. And so, the people inside continue to be well-intentioned. I think on some level what you have in America at this point is you have a very dysfunctional system in Washington where, you know, there's very little being done to really help Main Street, the average American, in terms of structural reform. And I think the Fed sees this, and the Fed realizes that even if its tools aren't perfect, someone should be doing something to try to help. And so I think a lot of the stimulus the Fed has actually done has been well-intentioned. I think the problem is that when you buy, over $4 trillion worth of financial assets, and when the actual impact has been minimal, when the Wall Street has benefited disproportionately from what the Fed has done, I think there comes a point at which an institution like the Fed really needs to take stock of whether things have been working. And even if things are not working in the rest of the United States government, perhaps the Fed really isn't the right place to launch this kind of stimulus. And perhaps, one of the arguments I'd make is perhaps had the Fed step back, we'd actually experienced a little bit more volatility over the last few years, maybe that would have incentivized some more meaningful reform in the rest of Washington.
All federal government programs develop constituencies. And so clearly, if you listen to the screams and the hollers from Wall Street when talk about tapering first broke out, clearly Wall Street was the constituency of continued quantitative easing.
For sure. I think this has been an incredible ride for Wall Street. Wall Street is back to being the largest corporate sector in terms of earnings in America. And in fact, among Wall Street, we really have to pinpoint the six big banks. In America today, the six big banks control 70% of the assets of the U.S. banking sector, which is amazing. This is, they are dramatically larger than they were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the 90 biggest banks controlled basically what the six biggest banks control today. So we have a bit of a banking cartel at the top of the industry, and it's quite uncompetitive. It's really not helping stimulate lending. They're still not really lending in large size 5 years after the financial crisis. And unfortunately, a lot of the stimulus that has been undertaken by the Fed has allowed them to effectively heal their wounds. But what they're doing with their repaired balance sheets is still doing a lot of the trading and a lot of the self-interested behavior that we saw leading up to the financial crisis. And that's really, again, why I wrote the op-ed in the end, is because I believed that we should speak up more about this idea of really more structural reform, hopefully breaking up the too-big-to-fail banks, and really trying to get the economy working for the average American again.
Well, your article certainly must have had an impact at the time in November when it appeared. It seemed that there was a certain amount of ambivalence, at least in the, at the policymaking level, about unwinding. They couldn't quite make up their mind. They had built in such a dependency on quantitative easing.
I hope so. I hope it helped make an impact. It came out right as the next chairwoman on the Fed, Janet Yellen, was being about to be nominated, and her hearings were about to take place. But I think we need to recall, you know, remember that the Fed still is pumping, even after it's, you know, it started to pull back on this stimulus, but it's still pumping, as of today, $55 billion of cash, newly printed cash, into the markets every month. And the reality is, it's still keeping rates artificially low. And we probably have another year to year and a half of moves by the Fed if it wants to actually pull back from its stimulus. And really, the real risk that we have is at some point, I believe, the markets are going to scream. We saw a little bit of this in early January when we saw a bit of a sell-off in the emerging markets. But I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more and more unintended consequences manifest themselves from the Fed pulling back. And on some level, that's necessary because that we need to get back to normal. But I think there's a real risk that the Fed may lose its nerve. And so we need to keep on talking about these issues and hopefully talk about larger structural reform as well.
Well, you're right. It seems that their resolve is pretty firm today, but I suppose any softening of the economy will get them to reconsider. So, but at the current rate, I mean, we seem to be on target to have ended quantitative easing at the current rate by, say, October. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. And I think you make a very good point about, you know, what's going to happen in the larger economy and macro economy. And in the end, how much is the Fed going to feel compelled to continue to try to support the economy with these imperfect tools? And again, let's all hope that the economy is improving and continue to improve. Unfortunately, we have a lot of the same issues that we've had before 2008, not only in terms of the banking sector issues I talked about, but even in terms of a continuing decline of the median American income, an incredible amount of structural unemployment, you know, the long-term unemployed in America, and most worryingly, the overarching cause, which is a continuing decline in the competitiveness of the U.S. economy. You know, in all the major areas, our economy continues to fall backwards relative to other economies in the world. And again, we're not doing a lot of the structural reforms as a country we need to do in order to support things like our infrastructure or our technological preparedness or our tax code or other areas in which we're just not really competing the way we were even 10 years ago as a country.
Andrew Huszar is our special guest. We'll take a short break and come back. I want to ask him, as the manager of Quantitative Easing 1 at the Fed, how all of this is unwound, what consequences all of these this massive growth in bank reserves will have on the economy. We'll do that in a moment. Our guest is Andrew Huszar. He wrote the piece Confessions of a Quantitative Easer that appeared in the Wall Street Journal back in November. And you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Huszar, Huszar. So my particular interest has been, the consequences of this massive explosion in bank reserves, what impact that has on the economy. How is this sanitized, if indeed it is? What are the Fed's options in your view, Andrew?
Well, the Fed traditionally has a set of tools to be able to pull back on reserves. And a lot that has really worked through sort of its tools in terms of ultimately controlling the short-term interest rates, what's called the Fed funds rate in America. The issue with quantitative easing is that it's a completely new program, effectively, that started Black Friday 2008, effectively. And now we are in this situation where the Fed had a balance sheet of $800 billion at that time, and now its balance sheet is about $4.25 trillion. And as you suggest, a lot of the reserves that have been pumped into Wall Street, they actually really haven't gotten out into the economy. We have well over $2 trillion of reserves sitting in the banking sector. And so the Fed is in a really interesting position because, again, its tools really haven't worked to stimulate credit as it had hoped. And on some level, if and when banks actually start doing what the Fed wants, there's this real danger that inflation could spike, because if banks are starting to lend and the cash gets out into the economy, it could really cause, you know, major turbulence in terms of inflation. So the Fed keeps on pumping money into the banks, hoping that it will help, but maybe not help too much because of the dangers. I think the real danger for us as a country and as a world economy is, number one, even if we ignore the idea of this immediate volatility that we may see in the markets when the Fed starts cutting its stimulus, you know, the point is, how does it control all this cash it's pumped into the banks? And the Fed has suggested more or less that the way it can do it is by paying banks interest to actually bank their excess reserves at the Fed. So banks actually turning around and banking their money at the Fed. What that really means is, in the matter of a few years, we could actually see the Fed paying tens of billions of dollars to banks to take their money and just bank it back at the Fed rather than lending it out. So it's a very perverse, unintended consequence. And there's a real question as to whether that tool would even work to really stem the tide of new lending that may occur. So I think the Fed, you know, with the best intentions, has created a real possibility for an out of control situation with respect to the amount of credit in America and the amount of cash flowing in our economy and some of the inflation possibilities down the line. It's unclear when it may happen, but there's a real risk that it could happen in the future.
Yes, it's a mixed blessing. We hope on the one hand for a recovered economy, but we fear the results of the multiplication of these reserves in the private lending process and the consequences that can have on the price level in the economy and more. So I feel that they've painted themselves into a corner. I'm not sure that there's any way out, and I have to imagine that at open market committee meetings, they're scratching their heads wondering what to do as well.
I mean, there are more extreme measures, I should say, that the Fed could take. The Fed could actually turn around and start selling assets, and that would be a way to soak up these excess reserves, because the minute you sell this paper out into the banking sector, the banks will give cash back to the Fed, and that will take the cash out of the system. The
problem is, what does that do to interest rates in this economy?
Exactly. And not only that, what does that do to asset prices? I mean, I think the Fed realistically can never do that, because just as the Fed has seen the stock market basically go up about 175% over 5 years based upon, you know, over $4 trillion of stimulus, the minute the Fed starts selling, the market will anticipate interest asset prices falling, and we could see a huge fall in asset prices. And so we have the situation where asset prices are being artificially kept up by the amount of stimulus, and the Fed, you know, as you suggest, is really painting itself in a corner as to what to do.
Well, we sure appreciate your courage in writing that piece, Confessions of a Quantitative Easer by Andrew Huszar, that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And it's, I guess it's sometimes just like the old wisdom is the simplest wisdom. The old wisdom always said, well, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think what we've done is we've reinforced what is an overly financialized U.S. economy, and something that unfortunately took 30 years to evolve to the point where it blew up in 2008. And unfortunately, we've maintained it. And so, you know, again, the reason I spoke up and the reason I'm going to keep on speaking up is because we really need to talk about these issues. And there is a way we can get the economy working again for all Americans, but we have to have courage and conviction about taking those moves. And sometimes doing short-term tactical things, they may seem good on the surface, but then, as you suggested before, you paint yourself into a corner, and I think we may have painted ourselves in a corner, you know, with our response to the financial crisis.
Well, thank you again for speaking up. Appreciate you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Huszar, our special guest today, and you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Huszar, at Andrew Huszar. And thank you for joining us today and every week. I'm Charles Goyette.
Thanks for listening to Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. Download a brand new episode every Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com. This has been a Podcast One production. Executive producer Norm Pattis.